Hi, I'm Sean. I've always had a passion for personal growth and a curiosity for life's profound questions. I created this show as a platform dedicated to inspiring change through thoughtful and insightful conversation. There's a lot happening in our world today. Some of it clear, some of it confusing. My goal with these conversations is to leave you feeling better and more informed about the state of our world in these challenging times. I'd like to invite you to think outside the lines. Hello, beautiful people, and thank you so much for joining me today. My guest today is an accomplished author and cognitive neuroscientist. His latest book, The Connected Species: How Understanding the Evolution of Our Brain Can Change the World, has become a bestseller and has ignited discussions on how our brain's evolution can shape the future. With a profound academic background in brain research and teaching, he's dedicated over 25 years to exploring the intricacies of our social skills. As a professor of cognitive neuroscience, he's conducted extensive behavioral and brain imaging research, unraveling the mysteries of how our brains function. His passion for education and the impact of modern technologies on our brains has led him to work with thousands of students, teachers, health professionals, and company directors. He runs programs on the neuroscience of learning, emotions, and the fascinating way our brains construct our reality. This is an incredibly timely and important conversation, and I can't wait for you to be inspired as we think outside the lines with Mark Williams. Dr. Mark Williams, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Sean.
Yeah, I'm really excited for our conversation today. I'm a big fan of the work that you're doing and the impact that you're making. So I'd love if you could start off by giving us a brief bit about your background. And specifically, I'm curious to know what you're doing to make the world a better place.
So yeah, I'm professor of cognitive neuroscience. So I've studied the human brain for a few years now. I won't say how many because that'll give my age away, but quite a few years, mainly with neuroimaging, but also a whole bunch of other new technologies that we now have to look at the brain. And about 5 years ago, I started working with schools as well and realized that there was a lot of new information that we know about the brain that wasn't really getting out to the general population, and we could help a lot of people if we got a lot of that information out there. So I started a company called Rethinking the Brain, where we work with organizations to make organizations brain healthy. So working with them to change things so that people are more brain healthy and are focusing more on their brains and what is healthy for their brains. I find that there's a big emphasis these days on keeping our bodies healthy, but not on keeping our brains healthy. And we don't really talk about brain health until it gets to the point where there's an issue. So, you know, we talk about mental health, but that does usually most people think about when things have gone wrong rather than keeping our brain healthy every day and keeping it in a way that means that we're not going to have those issues later on or at any stage when things go bad.
Yeah. And I'm actually really excited to kind of dive into some of that because I think it's really important. And I have some strong thoughts in that area myself. So I'm excited to chat about that. I guess I'm curious, what led you to focus on understanding how our brains work and the impact it has on our lives?
Yeah, that's a long story, to be honest. I grew up in a small country town, which was, I'm not going to say when because I'll give away my age, but we had high unemployment at that stage and it was a pretty rough place. My mother had a mental illness and she used to self-medicate with drugs. And so I hated school. I was one of those kids that teachers probably really tried to avoid having me in their classrooms. My principal, when I was 16, told my father and myself that I'd be in prison or dead by the time I was 25. So I wasn't really on a good trajectory. And it wasn't until I was 25 that two of my friends had drug overdoses. And so I decided to go back to school. And there was a physics teacher there that convinced me that I was more intelligent than I'd ever thought I was. And that I actually had something, you know, really to offer the world as everybody does, right? It's just got to be given the opportunity. So he talked me into doing a Bachelor of Science, going to university, which I hadn't thought about before. And when I got there, I decided to do a double major in physiology because I was really interested in our brains, and then in psychology because I was really interested in why my mother was the way she was and why I'd gone through a lot of the things I'd gone through and why a lot of my friends and, you know, family had gone through a lot of the things I'd gone through. So it was really a self-discovery point of view, which is never a good thing to to delve into a whole career based on self-discovery. But at the same time, I learn a lot, and I learn a lot about myself, and I learn a lot about my family and my friends, and it's been an amazing journey. And so I then went on and did a PhD in medicine, then studied the brain, and I've gone on to MIT and worked at McGovern Institute for Brain Research at MIT to again, look at the human brain and how the human brain works.
I think it's actually amazing when people pursue a career that's based on self-discovery. And I say that because I think that I wish that more people did that. It sounds like you have a background that caused you to want to study some of these things. And I find that really inspirational. And I'm guessing that that probably makes you even better at what you do because you have that personal insight on things. So I'm really inspired by that, actually.
Oh, thank you.
So your new book, The Connected Species, delves into the evolution of the human brain and its potential to change the world. What are some of the key insights from the book that you hope the reader will take away?
I think that the main one is that we need to spend more time with each other. And that's becoming more and more rare these days. We evolved into this so-called super species because of the fact of our connection, right? We're not the strongest species on the world, on the planet. We don't have the largest brain, and we're not the fastest of the species. What we did was we started actually collaborating with each other. We started helping each other. We started living in larger and larger groups, and that enabled us to actually thrive and come up with the amazing innovations that we've come up with. And unfortunately, we're now being driven apart. We're not as social as we used to be. And I think we need to realize that it's really important for us to become more connected rather than less connected. And we don't become connected over the internet. We've got to connect in real life because that's how our brains evolved. I mean, but the vast majority of our brains are actually dedicated to us being connected. And if we're not using that, then we're going to slowly lose it. And that's a real shame as well. And so we need to be spending more time with each other face to face so that we get all those really important neurotransmitters released and our brains are being exercised so that we are more healthy. And just sitting down and spending time with someone that you trust on a regular basis can increase your lifespan from 10 to 15 years and decrease the likelihood that you'll get Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases later on. So it's a really important thing for us to do and to do more well.
So there's lots to unpack there, and I'm looking forward to doing that. I guess just to kind of back up for a second, can you explain at a high level how our brains create a reality and some of the implications that this has on our perceptions and how we behave?
Yeah, I think that's one of the recent discoveries that I think people need to understand better. So what we receive, the information we receive is very different to the information that our brain actually shows us, if you like, or what we actually see. And so I'll give you just a quick example. So when I speak, if you're in the same room as me, it's more complicated over the internet, but if you're in the same room as me, my voice box vibrates and that causes a wave in the air, which travels through the air. And then that moves, you know, your eardrum and then three little bones and then another little eardrum and then your cochlea and a little hair cell pushes it up against your tympanic membrane, which causes activation in an area of your brain. And then your brain then creates an illusion that you're hearing a sound. But my voice doesn't create a sound. My voice simply moves air and creates a wave. And your brain then creates an illusion that you're hearing a sound because seeing or hearing these waves wouldn't make any sense at all. And so what we create and what our brains create in reality that we see is based on these illusions, which are transformations of the information that's receiving. And that information is very degraded. So it most of it's actually based on our memory rather than on what we're actually perceiving. And our connections and what we've experienced in the past changes how our brains create those realities that we actually see. And the people around us, of course, change those realities that we see. So we really need to understand that what we're perceiving isn't actually veridical. It's not what's actually out there. It's what our brain's creating based on our memory of what we've experienced previously and these really degraded inputs that we're actually receiving, and then transforming those inputs to create this new illusion that we see.
I want to talk about mental health because I think it's a topic that's at the forefront of many conversations these days, and for good reason. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that for so long mental health has been seen as something separate from how we think about and take care of the rest of the body?
That's a difficult question to answer. It's always been seen as something negative, something that we've shied away from. And I think there's a big difference between clinical mental health issues, you know, things like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and these things, which are really significant and have a huge impact on a person's life. And then the more subtle issues, such as, you know, people having anxiety. And anxiety, don't get me wrong, anxiety is an awful, awful thing to have, and it can cause really big impacts in your life. But we can deal with anxiety much more easily than we can with, say, things like schizophrenia and OCD. But I think a lot of people, when they think of mental health, they think of those really extreme disorders that cause really severe issues in people's lives, or can cause severe issues in people's lives. And they don't really think about the transition, those less severe disorders, which come about regularly for a lot of us, right? A lot of us will go through some of those issues throughout our lives. And so I think we need to, I'd like a change at where we actually think about brain health rather than think about mental disorders, so that we can all go, well, I want to keep my brain healthy just like I want to keep my body healthy. So it's something I'm going to do every day, rather than not sort of worrying about it until something severe happens, or until something happens and you need to actually deal with that more significant issue. I mean, it's the same as exercising, right? If you are keeping your body healthy, then you're much less likely to have issues. You might have a few minor issues, but because you're doing it regularly, then you deal with those at the time, and they don't become big issues. Whereas somebody who's not doing any exercise might notice those little issues as they come up, and so therefore they'll become big issues, and they won't actually notice them until they've become those really big problems.
So with respect to brain health, what would you say? Because I know there's been a lot of studies, right? And every day I think there's advancements. What are we finally getting right, and what are we still getting wrong on this topic?
So the big finding for me really was that our brains are plastic. So we used to think, based on Piaget's work and other scientists, that we went through these critical periods during our childhood and our adolescence, where if you made those pretty critical periods, then your brain was set that way. And then once you got past those ages, then you couldn't actually change your brain. And basically your brain developed up until in late teens, early 20s, and then your brain was set, and then it slowly atrophied after that, which is a pretty sad way to think about the brain and our lives. What we now know is actually that those critical periods don't exist, and our brain changes constantly throughout our lives. And so what we're doing in a positive way will actually improve our brain health and improve our brains and make them stronger. And things that we're not doing, similar to exercise, those abilities will slowly atrophy, and so we'll lose those abilities. So what we need to do is keep our brains healthy all the time. And we can learn, and we can do new things at any age if we choose to do that. And by doing that, we actually keep our brains healthier, and we stave off things like Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases later on. But even in earlier years, you can change your IQ quite significantly throughout your life. And during your teen years, your IQ can change up to 10 basis points, which is sort of the difference between going from an average student to well above average, or the difference between going from a well above average student to an average student, depending on what you're actually doing during those teen years. And that can also happen during your adult life. So you can improve your IQ during your adult life if you wish to do that. So I think that's a really important thing that we all need to recognize, that what we're doing is improving our brain if we're doing positive things, and the negative things we're doing, or if we're not actually using it, is going to negatively affect our brains at any stage in our life. And it's never too late to make positive changes.
Well, that's inspiring.
That's, yeah, especially for someone like,
right? Yeah. Well, I think anyone listening, though, you know, probably could use that wisdom. So earlier in the conversation, you touched upon technology, and I think that the influence of modern technology on our brain is a fascinating topic. And I'm curious if you could discuss some of the key ways technology is kind of shaping our cognitive experiences.
I mean, it's not the technology itself. It's just the way that we're actually using the technology, which is really a major issue, because we're not using it in a way which is optimized for us. We're using it in a way which is optimized for tech companies to make lots of money. And I think we need to that and start using technology in a way which is optimized for us and optimized for our brain, so that we can actually get more done rather than less done. But because we have notifications and things, you know, ringing at us and dinging at us and buzzing at us and jumping up and down all the time on our devices, on our laptops and on our computers and our phones. Those things are constantly distracting us. And every time we get distracted, we lose 90 seconds of our time, basically. And that's if we don't actually check it. So we have what's called a working memory. And our working memory is what we're actually aware of. It's what we sort of more generally think of as our consciousness, what we're aware of at any time. And it's basically what you're now using to listen to my voice so that you can understand what I'm saying and then interpreting that information. So that's what you're aware of. And hopefully you're blocking out everything else that's going on around you. For us to actually learn or for us to remember or for us to think deeply, we've got to hold information in our working memory for long enough for it to be transferred to this temporary store, and then it gets transferred to your long-term memory. Now, if your attention is caught, your attention is what decides what's in your working memory. If your attention is caught by a buzz or by, you know, a dog barking or whatever, your phone ringing or your phone making a ding or whatever, then your attention takes your working memory to that thing automatically. And you lose the last 90 seconds of what you were doing in your working memory. So you think about how many times you get distracted during the day by a ding or a buzz or whatever. Every time that happens, you're losing 90 seconds of your time, which is a lot of time that we're actually losing. And we find now that all of the research shows that we're less productive. We get less stuff done these days than we have in the past. So we were much more productive 15, 20 years ago than we are today. As individuals, companies have become more productive because of the systems that they have in the background running. We as individuals are getting less done, and yet we feel busier than we ever have been because we're constantly switching, because we can't multitask. So we can't do more than one thing at a time. If it's a cognitive thing, if it's a thing that we have to think about, our brains are incapable of because of that limit on our working memory and on our attention.
So like if this information isn't being transferred appropriately, what impact does that have on our long-term memories?
So it means that our long-term memories don't get the information. So we don't have as much information in our long-term memories, which means that we're not actually using our long-term memories as well as we used to. And we know that people, on average, we're actually getting dumber than we were 15 years ago. So for the first time in our history, our IQ at a population level is actually getting lower. So up until now, every year, or every 5 years or so, we used to assess IQ and we'd change our IQ paradigm so that everybody, the average is 100. And in the past, we've always had to make it a little bit harder, if you like. Now we're actually having to make it a little bit easier because of our population is actually getting less intelligent. So that's what's actually happening. It's actually, we're getting less intelligent. If you look at schools, for example, both here in Australia and the UK and in the US, kids today, when they finish year 12, are equivalent to kids 10 years ago who were leaving halfway through year 10 and a half. So they're a year and a half behind where we were 10 years ago when kids actually finished school because of the fact that we're not processing the information, we're not holding the information as well as we used to. There's also issues around kids and teens are more likely to have ADHD or autism who are given devices and use devices at a young age. And there's also lots of evidence now that our white matter tracts, which are the areas of our brains that connect different areas, they're sort of like the freeways, if you like, in a city that connect different suburbs together. Those areas aren't as well developed in children who are put on or given devices early on as those that actually go out and play and spend time with friends and so on.
So what impact is that having in both children and adults in terms of long-term brain health?
Yeah, so we're seeing an increase in early onset Alzheimer's disease. We're seeing an increase in Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases at an earlier age. We're seeing an increase in mental health issues. We're seeing an increase in loneliness. So all of these things are correlated and have occurred since we've been using these devices. And then there's a whole bunch of really good experimental studies which are showing that it is actually the devices, spending time on the devices, that are causing a lot of these issues.
Yeah. So I mean, without revealing my age either, I feel so fortunate to have experienced a childhood where I was not staring at a screen all day, right? And I'm constantly curious as to the impact that that's having on younger generations. And I'm curious if you can maybe talk about any studies to suggest that the greater impact that this is having on the long term of our society, right? And I'm thinking specifically about things like social media, particularly you know, the impact that that has on young people.
Yeah, it is a concern. So there's some great studies coming out now. One was done where they just simply took a whole bunch of, I think it was year six or year seven, so around the age of 11 or 12, they took a whole bunch of these kids out into on camp where there was no internet access and they didn't have any access to devices for 5 days. And they found with these kids, if you just take them out and don't give them any access to devices for 5 days, you get a significant increase in their ability to recognize facial expressions and their ability to empathize with other kids. And that's after only 5 days, which suggests that and these are normal kids. These weren't kids who are addicted to the phones or anything like that. These were just normal kids. And so that suggests that their normal ability when they're on the phones every day is lower in their ability to empathize with people and to actually perceive their facial expressions. But there's also a great study done in Spain. Multiple of the provinces there have actually banned smartphones from schools, but other provinces haven't. So you couldn't design an experiment better, to be honest, because you've got thousands of schools that you can look at that are either banned the phone or not banned the phone. And you can look across, of course, the wealthy areas versus not wealthy areas and private schools and not private schools, public schools and so on. And they've found that schools that ban the phones result in less cyberbullying in the schools, which is not surprising, but also less normal bullying, less loneliness in the schools and better outcomes. So that their actual educational outcomes have significantly improved in those schools where they've just banned the smartphone from the schools. And that's across thousands of schools in Spain, which is very, very cool. And showing the impact that these things are having on both their intelligence, their educational outcomes, but also their ability to actually socialize and spend time with other kids.
I'm curious what advice you would give to a parent listening. How can they navigate this? Because I think you've got the parents want one thing, and then the kids are obviously being exposed to another thing, whether it's school, with their friends, outside of the home even. How do you even manage that today?
Yes, and it's a difficult, don't get me wrong, it's a difficult issue. I have teenage kids myself, and it's, but we need to be parents, right? And we need to actually parent our children so that they grow up to be great kids. I don't think any child should have a smartphone until they're in high school. I see that there is a need once they get to high school, and my children needed one when they got to high school because they had to travel quite a way to get to school, and then they do things after school and so on. So just the safety aspect to it was really important, but neither of them are on social media. We know social media causes significant issues with mental health in teenagers. So neither of them have social media, and neither of them really need social media, because social media is, there's nothing social about social media. Social media is just advertising. It's either individuals advertising how wonderful their lives is, or it's companies advertising things that they want to sell, right? There's nothing social about it. So that they don't need that, and they can text with each other. And they're turning off all the notifications. We know that whether it's adults, it's teenagers, if you turn off all the notifications on your phone, mental health actually improves within 2 weeks. So you'll actually have better mental health within 2 weeks if you simply turn off all your notifications, because the notifications are the thing that actually captures our attention and causes a lot of the anxiety that we see. So yeah, simply turning off all your notifications and just having it so that it actually rings like an old fashioned phone. And then you check your notifications when you're ready to do that, right? You actually schedule into your day, or your team's schedule into their day, when they're going to look at Facebook, or when they're going to look at TikTok, or when they're going to do all these things. And so that's another really easy thing that you can actually do, we can all do, to actually improve our mental health and our relationship with the phone. And then the other thing that I do specifically with my kids is we all have the health apps turned on all out. We have a fun little time where we all look at what each of us has been doing, have the percentages and the times that we've been spending on the different apps and the different devices and so on. And then we basically have a little competition going to have the least amount of time. And to be honest, I'm worse than my teenage daughter, because of the fact that, you know, my work and everything else. And so she loves chastising me and beating me on the number of hours on the device and the number of hours on different social media programs and so on. So that's another way, you know, you set up a bit of a competition in the family, and you all have that open discussion about why you're doing certain things and why you need to spend time doing different things. Because I think education is always really the key. And so having the information there that you can actually look at and you can discuss it, and you can see how much each reviewer is doing. Because a lot of us don't realize how much time we're actually spending scrolling through these mindless, you know, social media apps and so on. So yeah, having the actual data is really important too.
Yeah, I actually interviewed a guest who suggested that on average, people spend about 9 hours per day on their devices, which is just astounding if you think about how much time of our lives we're actually wasting on these things.
Yeah, it's really, really sad. And I mean, if I turned around to you and said, hey, I'm going to get you to work for me for 9 hours a day, doing something that's actually going to negatively impact on your mental health and on your brain, and it's going to take you away from your family and friends, but I'm not going to pay you for it, you'd think I was mad, right? But we're actually doing that, right? We're actually working for these tech companies. Yeah, we're working for these tech companies. Tech companies are making huge amounts of money out of our attention, out of keeping us on these devices. And we need to rethink that.
Yeah. Well, I do want the conversation to become more uplifting at some point. And I promise we'll get there. But before we do that, I briefly want to touch upon depression and anxiety, because I think they're topics that are kind of top of mind for me right now. I'm noticing there's a lot of it in the world. And, you know, obviously, since we have limited time today, I'm interested to get your take on kind of what is happening in the brain of people with these conditions, and what does science suggest might help them?
Yeah, it's awful what's happening across the world, and it's been exacerbated, of course, because of COVID. But it was occurring before COVID. It's not simply because of COVID. It was something that was on the rise before. And look, with anxiety, well, especially social anxiety, which is the one issue that's really been on the rise, and especially since COVID, it has a lot to do with the fact that, again, our brains are plastic, and so our brains change constantly and adapt to our situation. So, I mean, COVID's a good example. So when we had COVID and a lot of areas went into lockdowns, or, you know, we're all told to socially isolate, and anybody who, you know, didn't want to get COVID was spending a lot of time at home or a lot of time by themselves or just within their small family group. And so during that time, your brain would adapt. It would naturally adapt to that situation. Neuroplasticity would take over, and you'd start to get used to having less people around and being around less people on a regular basis. And so then when we're all of a sudden told, okay, you know, everything's okay and we can go out and spend time with each other, then going out and spending time with each other, of course, your brain's then not used to that situation. It's adapted to a situation where it's isolated. And so it then sets off this fight or flight response, which is really what social anxiety is about. It's about your fight or flight response being overactive in social situations. And so all of a sudden your fight or flight response is kicked off, which means your heart rate starts pounding, you know, start increases. And so you feel as though your heart's pounding. You get a strange feeling in your stomach because your blood is actually pumped to your muscles so that you can run away or so you can fight whatever it happens to be. And so on. So these things happen because of the fact that our brains have adapted to not having many people around, and then all of a sudden you're thrown into a situation where there are people around. And the only way to really get over that is to spend time with people, is to readapt your brain to this new situation, and so to actually be spending more time with people. But the best cure or the best treatment that we currently have for both depression and anxiety is actually to sit down and chat to someone. So sitting down face to face with someone and talking to someone is better for both depression and anxiety, better treatment for depression or anxiety than any drug that we currently have on the market. The pharmaceutical companies hate it when I say that, but it's actually true. The best way you can get over social anxiety or depression, unless it's at the level of clinical depression, which is again that extra level. So I'm not talking about that clinical depression, but not, yeah, you know, that your average depression or social or anxiety, the best treatment is to actually, yeah, spend time with people you trust on a regular basis, face to face, and just chat with them.
Interestingly, I recently saw an interview with a neuroscientist, I think it was from Stanford, and his hypothesis basically suggested, and I hope I'm getting this right, but it was essentially that utilizing techniques to perhaps rewire the synapses in the brain might be exponentially more impactful than things like SSRIs or some of the drugs that people use for these conditions, which, you know, I've also heard can often have a delayed effect, and they might not even be helpful in some cases. Do you have any perspective on this? It sounds like that's kind of where you were touching upon a moment ago. I find it incredibly fascinating how much we learn about the brain with every day that passes.
Yeah, absolutely. So in it is, it's just due to this, you know, happy, the changes in neuroplasticity, it changes in synaptic connection is the neuroplasticity that's occurring. So the neuroplasticity we talk about, it's more of a global thing, whereas the changes in synapses is talking about it at the neural level. But actually just doing things that are positive and spending time with people that you trust is going to activate those areas of your brain associated with positive outcomes. You're going to get things like serotonin and oxytocin released in your brain, which both make you more willing to actually trust people, but more open and actually feel as though you're connected to the person. Oxytocin is actually also the neurotransmitter that's released when you have an orgasm. So it's quite a good neurotransmitter to have released. And you can have that released by just spending time with people and touching people in appropriate ways. And so this is why it's really important to go face to face with people and actually spend time with people, because your neurotransmitter release, which will then activate these different synaptic connections, which will then strengthen those synaptic connections. Because we've known for a long time from Hebbian learning that cells that fire together wire together. And so if you're activating the neurons that make you feel positive, make you feel happy, then those neurons become more active and those neurons then become stronger and the connections become stronger. And so they're more likely to fire in the future. And those connections associated with feeling lousy are going to become less connected and so therefore less likely to activate in the future. So it's a fairly simple scenario where, if you're doing positive things, you're going to feel positive, but you're also more likely to feel positive in the future. And doing things, as I said, like hanging out with people or going to the beach or doing things that make you feel happy are going to mean that you're actually going to feel happy, but you're more likely to feel happy in the future as well.
Create positive habits. That's what I'm hearing.
Yeah, absolutely. And hang out with people who are also positive, right? Because
Definitely. We
mimic what we're around. The people we're around, we actually mimic through the mirroring neuron system. So therefore, hanging out with people who make us feel happy, hanging out with people who are positive themselves will also result in positive changes. Right.
What are some other exciting advancements or discoveries in the field that you believe have the potential to change our understanding of the brain?
Yeah, there are lots of changes that we've now seen. One of them that I really like is the fact that we actually learn by making mistakes. And this is one that I spend a lot of time trying to work with both organizations and schools on, but that our brain doesn't actually learn when we get things correct. Our brain actually learns when we're making mistakes. And I'll give you a little example. As when we're toddlers, when we're young, and before we've actually know what a dog is, the first time we see a dog, our carer will actually look at the dog and say, "Dog." And our brain automatically makes up a hypothesis there. And there's two hypotheses. Either that's a dog, that's item called dog, and that's its name. And there's just one of them, and that's the only one I'll see. Or there's a lot of these things that I'm going to see in the future, and they're all called dog. There are a whole category of things called dogs out there in the world. Then the next time the carer actually looks at a dog, the infant then turns around and goes, their brain automatically goes, "Ah, I made a mistake. It's not an item. That's not its name. There's a whole category of these things. And therefore, I'm going to see lots of them." Now, that's amazing that we can actually learn something like that. And our brain actually does learn constantly like that with just two trials, just experiencing twice. A computer to do the same thing, or what we're currently calling artificial intelligence, which isn't intelligent at all, but is simply learning algorithms that we're using. They take thousands and thousands of trials to actually learn the same thing, whereas our brain can do it in two trials, but based on social learning, right? Learning from somebody else and making a mistake. So, those things I think are really important, that A, we learn extremely well socially. We learn from each other. We don't learn as well when we're trying to learn by ourselves. And B, that we learn by making mistakes, and therefore we've got to be allowed to make mistakes, and we've got to actually be positive with students and everybody and organizations and so on when people make mistakes, because that's the learning process and that's really important to do.
What role do you think AI will play in how we study the brain and what we learn about it?
Yeah, we call it AI. It's not really AI at all. I think there's a lot of tech people out there using the term AI because people get scared by AI, and so therefore
I've heard enhanced intelligence is a better way to describe it.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it intelligence at all, because intelligence requires that you're actually creating something new, that you're actually able to come up with a new concept or a new idea. Whereas these are learning algorithms, which we've had for a long time. The only thing that's changed is that we have huge amounts of data now, and we also have computers that can work much quicker than they could in the past. So they're simply learning algorithms. So they're your use rather than actually creating anything unique or new. So I wouldn't call, I'd call them what they are, which is learning algorithms rather than artificial intelligence. It's been used, I was using it 25 years ago to actually analyze fMRI data, which is really, really interesting. So analyzing data that we're getting off the scanner about how the brain's actually working. And we've made some huge leaps in our understanding about how the brain works using these learning algorithms to actually analyze that data. And there's also some really cool research going on looking at patient data. So looking, you get, you know, a whole bunch of scans that we know. One is, you know, patients who have contracted Alzheimer's versus those that haven't contracted Alzheimer's, and you put all this into the learning algorithm. And then you can give them new sets of data of new people, and it can determine whether or not this person's going to get Alzheimer's disease or not going to get Alzheimer's disease, for example, and therefore diagnosing these diseases much earlier so that we can start treating them much earlier, so the outcomes will be better and we can actually help them at an earlier stage. So there's some great research in that area where we're using these algorithms, these learning algorithms, to analyze data and also to work out how the brain's actually working. Because neuroimaging data, brain imaging data, is, it's huge amount of data that we get every time we do it. And so using them to compact that, and that's what devices do really well, right? That's what computers do really well, is use, take huge amounts of data and consolidate it down to give us answers about what's actually there and what we can actually use.
So as it pertains to something like Alzheimer's, what are the benefits of diagnosing it early enough? And what are there new things that you guys are learning in terms of what can be done to either?
Yeah, great question. There are some new drugs being tested at the moment, which seem to be really potentially, I won't say definitely, but yeah, potentially quite good at decreasing the progression of Alzheimer's, which is great. So that's really cool. We do also know that, and we've known for quite a while now, that it's based, the likelihood of you getting Alzheimer's or any of these dementias is based on whether or not you have extra capacity. So if you've got a really strong and healthy brain, then you're less likely to get those diseases. Because if you like, it's sort of like there's a boundary limit where, you know, once your brain gets to a certain level of ability, then you're more likely to get Alzheimer's disease. So if you can keep your brain healthy and working really well, then you never get to that border stage where you're more likely to get Alzheimer's disease and so on. So really just keeping your brain healthy and active is probably the best way to actually stop or decrease the likelihood of you getting those diseases later on. But yeah, there are some really cool drugs that they're working on at the moment that seem to slow the progression. We don't at this stage have anything that is will potentially actually cure these disorders, sadly. But yeah, there are some that will actually really slow down the progression.
How far away do you think we would be from a cure? I know there's probably not a direct answer to that question, but based on the progress that you have seen, do you feel like it's in our future, or do you think it's still pretty hopeless?
I'm pretty hopeful, to be honest. Yeah, we understand it a lot better than we have ever had in the past. Obviously, we're always, you know, studying it and getting closer to what's going on. There's a lot of people now studying, you know, people in their 90s and their 100s to work out why these individuals get to those ages and still have full cognitive capacity. And so that's helping as well. So hopefully, you know, we are getting closer to some sort of cure. I mean, I think it'll probably be a vaccine which will stop us from getting it to begin with, rather than an actual cure once you've got the disease. I think curing the disease once you've got it is going to be a very difficult task, whereas I think coming up with some sort of vaccine which stops us from getting it in the first place, I think, is probably more likely.
Is that because once you've got it, the damage is essentially done?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. So once you've got the Alzheimer's, it really is throughout several areas of the brain that you get these amyloids, which are actually damaging the neurons and damaging the connections. So curing that I think would be really difficult, and getting rid of those amyloids and so on would be really a difficult task. And that's why, you know, most of the drugs just slow the progression and stop or slow the development of those amyloids and so on. So yeah, I think it'd be more likely that we'll end up with some sort of vaccine that will stop us from getting in the initial stage.
That's very promising. I guess so. It's very clear that maintaining brain health is critical as we think about longevity. What are some general tips that you might share for keeping the brain healthy for hopefully a lifetime?
Yeah, just spending time with people is really number one, actually having loved ones and close friends that you actually spend time face-to-face with. So schedule time. I regularly catch up with friends for coffee, and I make sure I schedule that into each week, and that I have a range of different friends that I catch up with and just chat about how their life's going and how my life's going. And then keeping your body, because you know your brain is part of your body, so keeping your body healthy, so exercising regularly, drinking enough water, not drinking too much alcohol. A little bit is, of course, is there's no problem at all, but not drinking too much alcohol is good, especially not binge drinking. So you know, drinking one or two glasses of wine every day is much better than drinking 14 glasses on one session, for example. So that's important. Eating healthy food on a regular basis is also important. And then, of course, getting enough sleep is really critical. So there's some great studies recently actually suggesting that having a nap during the day is actually really beneficial for your brain health. So having a 20 to 40 minute nap in the middle of the day is actually a really good way. You shouldn't nap for too long, because if you do that, then of course it disrupts your ability to sleep at night. But yeah, having a short nap during the day, which I like, because I've always been a keen napper. That one I really like. And that's an easy one. And for us all.
I think there's going to be a lot of people that are really unhappy about the 14 glasses of wine. I think you just bummed a lot of people out there that they can't indulge that way. Can you touch upon sleep really quickly? Because I've read a lot of studies recently that suggest that sleep is actually quite critical to long-term brain health.
Yeah, it definitely is. There's lots of research now. So we used to think that we just slept for protection. So, you know, nighttime was a dangerous time for us. So we slept at night so that we'd go into caves and hide away and sleep. We now know that it's actually not for that reason, but rather there's a whole bunch of beneficial things that happen during sleep that we really need. And so there's five stages to sleep. And a couple of those are involved in basically just doing a service on your brain, if you like, sort of like a car, so that it goes through and gets rid of all the extra neurotransmitters that have been released. So our neurons connect to each other, talk to each other by neurotransmitters. So one neuron will release neurotransmitters, and then they'll connect to the next neuron, which will activate that one. But in that process, that always releases more neurotransmitters than you actually need. So during sleep, it sort of mops up all those extra neurotransmitters that are formed, and also mops up any chemicals and things that are in your brain that are not good for you. So it gets rid of bad toxins and so on that are formed in your brain during the day. So it sort of does this, clean on your brain. And also goes through your memory system and works out what memories you actually need and what memories you're not actually needing, and sort of rejigs everything in your brain based on what you've been doing that day. And then you also go through an emotional reset. So it sort of goes through what you've done during that day and makes you more calm about everything that you did that during that day, so that you wake up the next day feeling better about what actually happened. And then it forms lots of memories. So it forms all your memories. It lays them down in stronger form at night as well. So it goes through what you did that day, actually in reverse order. So it starts at the end of the day and then slowly goes through to the early parts of the day, and lays down memories that it thinks are going to be important for you in the future. And then you go through a whole bunch of scenarios. So, you know, what we think of as our dreams is actually our brain going through scenarios based on what we did that day, so that we can learn how to do those things better. Which is really cool that we go through all these. And that's why during teen years, it's a really important for teenagers to actually get a good night's sleep, at least 8 hours to 10 hours of sleep, because they learn how to actually communicate and how to relate to people during those dream states. So, you know, if they go through scenarios as to what actually happened that day and how they could have done it better and how they could have responded differently, and scenarios as to what could have happened if they had responded differently. So yeah, there are a whole bunch of really important things that our brain goes through during those sleep periods, which both teach us and lay down our memories and reset our brain for the next day so that we're, you know, back to stage one and we can be a very productive and healthy member of society.
You have alluded a couple of times throughout the conversation to connectivity to other humans. And I think one of the things that I'm particularly passionate about is especially as of late, and it's something that I'm trying to tailor a lot of these conversations to whenever possible. It's how can we foster more positive connections and empathy as we seemingly find ourselves continually faced with divisiveness and polarization in the world. I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
It is something that I really am focused on, and it's something that my book really focuses on, given it's called The Connected Species, and there's lots of tips and tricks in the book as to how to do that. But I think one of the biggest problems with society at the moment is we're all busy, and we're all too busy to actually spend time with each other, which is crazy. And we're busy because we're not getting stuff done, and we don't get stuff done as quickly as we could before. But one of the outcomes of that busyness is we don't actually listen to each other anymore, and we don't have conversations with people anymore. So a lot of people now, if you listen to the conversation, there's no gaps between one person speaking and the next person speaking, which means that they're not actually listening to each other. Because if you think about it, if I'm listening to we're sitting in a cafe and we're having a coffee together, and you're telling me about, you know, your relationships or your day or your work or whatever it happens to be, and then I speak as soon as you finish, it means that I haven't actually had time to process what you've actually said and then think about it to actually then respond to it in a nice way. What I'm doing is I'm just telling you what I've already been thinking about, how I want to respond to what you're saying, but I haven't actually thought about it. So one thing I teach, especially leaders is and people who are trying to, you know, lead in an organization, is when you're having a conversation, stop at the end. When somebody's speaking, when they finish speaking, wait a minute and think about what they've actually said. And that's really important because it gives you time to actually think about what they've said, which is what you should be doing when you're having a conversation. But also it shows them that you're actually thinking about what they've actually said. And so they will actually be more open and connected to you because they can see that you're actually taking in what they're saying and you're appreciating what they're saying, and then you're responding to what they're saying rather than all of us having stuff in our head that we want to tell someone else and then getting out of there without actually listening to. So I think, not be busy, slowing down and actually listening to people, I think is a really, really important thing for us all to be doing.
What is something specific that you maybe haven't gotten a chance to address yet, but you really would like to drive home and make sure that someone listening today takes away from this conversation?
And really that we are connected, that we're all connected across the whole world, that our species is the only species that connects across groups. And that's how we've got to this point, right? If you think about, say, bees have amazing little communities where they're all connected to each other within those communities. But one beehive would never lend honey to another beehive or tell another beehive that there's some cool flowers over there that you can go and pollinate, for example. We are the only species that actually connects across groups like that. And that has enabled us to become the amazing connected species that we are. You know, I'm working on a laptop, and all of the bits and pieces that have come together to make that laptop come from all over the world, from all different societies and all different religions and all different countries. And none of that could come about, and I couldn't be talking to you now if we all didn't collaborate and we all weren't connected in that way. And I think we need to come back to the realization that we're all important and we're all contributing to this amazing society, huge society across the world that we have, and that's really important, and that we all need to come back to the fact that we've all got something to offer, that we're all actually contributing to this amazing world. And if we all get together, we can solve a lot of these problems that we have and stop disconnecting the way we are at the moment and stop isolating ourselves. Because, you know, I love that there's all these trolls on the internet saying nasty things to people via these computers, that all these people that they're saying nasty things to probably contributed in some way to that person actually having that computer. So they really should be thanking them for that opportunity rather than being nasty about it. So I think if we can all just appreciate the fact that we're all part of this. We're all on this same big rock that's turtling around the universe, and we need to look after it. We need to look after each other.
Yeah, I'm particularly fascinated by the trolls in the sense that, you know, I'm always curious to know how many of those people would actually say those things to someone's face if they were face to face, right? And I think that's a big problem with our society today is that we are on opposite sides of a screen. So it's much easier to be, you know, hostile or aggressive towards someone where you probably would not behave that way, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And we wouldn't do that face to face. And there's a bunch of reasons why we wouldn't do it face to face, because we've evolved in our whole brain that makes us automatically empathize with the person we're opposite to, which we don't get when we're actually on a screen. So if you're sitting opposite someone or you're standing opposite someone, then the first thing we always do is actually touch each other, because, you know, in all societies, we have some way of touching each other in an appropriate way when we actually greet. So in stoic societies like, you know, the US and here in North America and here, we shake hands. And, you know, in Europe, of course, they kiss each other on the cheek. Even the Inuits will rub noses. And the reason we do that is that we have sea fibers on our skin, and those sea fibers activate an area of our brain, which releases oxytocin, which makes us more connected to the person that we're actually just touched. And therefore, you're actually more likely to relate to them and actually empathize with them. And then we also have the mirror neuron system, which when we're actually face to face with each other, we automatically read each other's body language, which we don't get online because you only see the top half, you only see from the shoulders up, or you don't see them at all because you're on social media or whatever. But that mirror neuron system automatically makes our muscles go into the same position or similar position to the person that we're actually looking at. So if they're actually feeling sad and they're hunched over, then our area of our brain associated with us hunching over and therefore feeling sad becomes active. So we feel the same way. So we're much less likely to actually make someone feel sad because it'll make us feel sad as well. Whereas we don't get that when we're on, we don't get any of that extra information when we're online. And similarly, our facial expressions and all those sorts of things, we automatically perceive those facial expressions and we feel the same way as that person's feeling. So if you make someone sad by being nasty to them, you're actually going to start feeling sad yourself. So you're less likely to do it, or you're going to empathize with them and apologize to them as soon as that happens. But we get none of that. We never get none of those really important neurotransmitters released, and we get none of that information and that feedback for ourselves when we're online. And that's why I think we've got a lot of these trolls and so on, because they're not getting the normal responses in their brain that we would get when we're actually communicating with someone.
I've always been more of a hugger than handshaker. I think the handshake can be like, sometimes people have sweaty palms, it can be awkward. The hug feels like it's like, you know, more authentic, but you know, to each their own. I get what you're saying for sure.
I'm with you 100%. My wife's a huge hugger, and her family was always a huge hugger. And I came from a very stoic, you know, family. And so we were never huggers, but now I'm a huge hugger. I absolutely agree. It just opens up the conversation and opens up the relationship so much quicker if you actually hug someone. Yeah. And again, it's those sea fibers, you know, it's our brains just being tricked into saying, hey, I like this person.
Yeah. A question I end all my conversations with, what has you hopeful?
To be honest, though, I think this is really sad, but I think COVID actually made me really positive. I saw a lot of people come together during COVID, and I saw a lot of people, you know, people realizing how important connection is, and people, you know, those films in Europe, little videos in Europe where you saw a whole communities playing across balconies because they were missing each other. So they were playing musical instruments, you know, the bands were getting together across balconies and people handing out things for people who couldn't go out or who had problems and couldn't access. I think that a lot of those things that I saw, I really looked at the positive during COVID and the positive things that actually happened during COVID, and saw that a lot of people want to connect, and there is a lot of love out there. It's just, we need that to become more prolific across society. So yeah, that made me positive. I know it was an awful time for a lot of people, and there was a lot of bad things that happened, and we're still, you know, a lot of people are still suffering from that. But I did notice that there was a lot of people who reached out and helped that hasn't happened before. So I'm hoping that that will make a change, and I'm hoping that that will spur more people on to be more connected.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think we're still kind of coming out of it and seeing what's on the other side of all that. And so it's been fascinating to watch, and I'm with you. It leaves me optimistic in a lot of ways. Well, this conversation has been so much fun, and I want to say thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your insight with us, especially all the way over on the other side of the world. please tell those listening how they can connect with you.
The best way is my website is just Dr. Mark Williams, dmarkwilliams.com. So drmarkwilliams.com. That's, if you want to sign up to my newsletter, it's on there, and you'll get your monthly tips and tricks from me if you're interested in that. Or you can contact me via the contact page, and there's a whole bunch of stuff on there as well. You can look down videos and so on. Also, the link to my book is there, or you can purchase my book at any of your favorite retailers, is what the publishers have been told me to say. Yeah. I'm not allowed to pick on any particular book retailer, but you can buy the book at any retailer, The Connected Species by Mark Williams.
Well, thank you again so much. Like I said, I really appreciate your time, and I had a lot of fun with this conversation. So please do stay in touch.
Thank you, Sean. It's been really, really great to chat with you.
All right. I want to thank my guests today for sharing their insight with us. And I'm incredibly grateful to you for taking the time out of your day to listen to this conversation. I hope it left you better and smarter. If you haven't already, please be sure to subscribe and leave a review for the show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have an idea for a future guest or a particular topic you'd like me to cover, you can email me directly, hello@thinkoutsidethelines.com. Now may you go out into the world today and leave things better than you found them. For more information, please visit thinkoutsidethelines.com.